Please listen carefully.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Bring Your Own Kombucha podcast. We are in episode 7 right now of season 2, and today's guest is my friend Chanel Kenner. She is a certified nutrition coach and clinical nutrition student on track to become a registered dietitian. I look to her all the time for advice, especially when I was pregnant. I was constantly reaching out to her regarding nutrition advice, but more so than that, she's a wife and a mama bear to a sweet little funny 9-month-old Sophie. You'll see her all over her Instagram. She's so adorable. And Chanel, similar to me, also writes for A Sweat Life, and she talks about all things nutrition and healthy lifestyle, and contributes to nutrition-related articles on publications like Reader's Digest. And she recently launched a podcast called Learned, Heard, and Stirred. It's more of like, to her, this is how she described it, a sporadic hobby at this time because she's mom and school and work life. But if you tune into it, I promise you, you're going to get so much good science-backed nutrition information. It's well worth the listen. And they're usually pretty short, so it's easy to listen to it on your morning commute or while you're running an errand and the like. I actually had Chanel back on from her previous... So I actually interviewed Chanel 1 year ago when she was pregnant with Sophie. So it was really cool to see, her advice back then and then her advice for postpartum. It's just such a change when you become a mom. It's indescribable. So I'm really excited for you guys to hear this episode. Another thing I want to mention is that if you are close to NYC, I am partaking in the Nourished Retreat on April 27th. So make sure you get your tickets. If you use the code Kombucha, you'll save, you'll get a discount on your ticket, and I'm actually going to do a live podcast recording. I'm not going to announce who I'm interviewing just yet, but I will be doing a live podcast recording. It's going to be so much fun. Typically at the Nourished Retreat, there is yoga meditation in the morning, and then there's a marketplace filled with tons of health and wellness vendors. And shout out to Blooming Lotus Jewelry because they will be there. I love Jen over at Blooming Lotus. And you get a awesome swag bag when you come in full of tons of products. And then there's going to be a ton of lectures, regarding the health and wellness world. And it's just a really great event. Let me tell you, I went to the first one about 2 years ago and I made so many connections and friends from that event. It was honestly mind-blowing. I had no idea I would connect with so many people and still be friends with them today, and work with them today. So if you're in the health and wellness atmosphere, you just want to learn more, this retreat is totally for you. Like I said, it's just one day. It's from like 9 a.m. to maybe 4 p.m., but you can come and go as you please. It's in New York City. And I will leave all the information about it in the show notes. And, of course, feel free to reach out to me if you have any more questions. All right. That was a lot. Let's jump in. One more thing before we jump in, I do want to give a huge shout out to Casandrinos Olive Oil. They sponsored this podcast episode, and I just want to give them the proper shout out. Casandrinos Olive Oil is a Greek extra virgin olive oil company owned by a brother and sister, Tony and Effie Casandrinos, And it all started back when Tony was sharing some of his family's olive oil with friends at his local CrossFit gym. And then eventually over time, word built up with all the foodies and everybody was asking for their own bottle to take home. And now, and of course I always like to keep you guys informed, so I just want to share a little known fact about the olive oil industry. So basically, it's not a heavily regulated industry. That's why using companies like Casandrinos, who are so transparent, is super important. Like I mentioned, there's a lot of, for lack of a better term, like fraud in the olive oil industry. A lot of companies dilute their brands with, you know, grapeseed oil and different oils, and Casandrinos does not do that. They source their olives from orchids in Laconia, Greece. They're pressed within 48 hours of harvest. They only use the current year's harvest of olive oil as opposed to most store-bought brands. And it is organic. It's USDA approved. They have a PGI certification, which relates to the source of the olives. And they also perform a third-party chemical analysis on every batch of olive oil and post the results on Casandrinos.com. If that's not transparent, guys, I don't know what is. I definitely think you guys need to head over and give it a try. Believe me, at first I was like, okay, organic olive oil, it makes sense. But once I tasted it, I was like, oh my gosh, I have been like duped my whole life basically, because I didn't realize that pure olive oil tasted so different from the conventional brands that really are diluted. So give Casandrinos a shot. Head over there, and if you use the code kombucha, you'll save an additional 10% off. All right, guys, let's get this episode started. Hi, Chanel, and welcome back to the Bring Your Own Kombucha podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Of course. So since we last had you on the podcast, you had a little baby girl.
I did, Sophie.
And she's absolutely adorable.
She's not so little anymore. I'm sorry.
How old is she now?
She's almost 9.5 months.
Oh, my gosh. And she's just the cutest little babe.
Thank you. Well, Lizzie, too.
Thank you. So why don't you give everybody just a brief background about yourself, just in case they didn't hear the prior podcast.
Sure. So I'm Chanel Kenner. I'm a certified nutrition coach. I've been doing that for a couple of years. So I work with clients one-on-one to really help with overall like lifestyle choices to live a healthier life. And I am in school for clinical nutrition to become a registered dietitian.
So what made you want to take that extra step? And because, you know, you were a nutritionist and you still are. But what made you want to take that step and pursue being a dietitian?
Yeah, well, the science is really interesting to me. There hasn't been anything I've done before that I've been so passionate about. I think part of that, you did talk about my eating disorder past on the previous episode. I'm not going to go deep into it, but I did suffer from an eating disorder, anorexia, when I was newly in high school. So I'm celebrating, I think it's 18 years this year of being recovered. So, but I think my fascination with the science just kind of supports. I like knowing about the more I know about a topic, the less fear I have about it. And I think it's, you know, it's easy with so much misinformation out there to have fear attached to things that, you know, may or may not be like real valid fears. And so I feel like science has really helped me with removing any sort of, you know, the residue fears about things. And also to better serve the people I work with, I feel like the more I can speak to things from like a research supported perspective, the more I am giving like you know, safe and responsible information. So that was my personal reason for doing it. It's a little insane. I'm now entering my mid-30s, and I'm in class with, like, 20-year-olds. But, you know, it keeps me kind of, like, on trend in some ways. I find out, like, what the kids are doing. So
that's so funny. Yeah. I love that you refer to them as kids, because essentially they are, but...
they really are. I mean, it's funny. I often feel like the professors are very condescending, and not intentionally, but they speak to the class as if we're all in the same boat, and I just want to, like, raise my hand and say, first of all, I'm probably older than you.
Right.
Second of all, like, I've had, you know, a career. I've worked for many years, like... I show up on time to class, but they're speaking to the majority who are, you know, they're entering this stuff for the first time and don't know any of it. So it is a culture shock in a lot of ways.
I can definitely see that. So I really want to talk to you today about pregnancy nutrition and I guess like postpartum nutrition. So would you mind sharing with us how your nutrition has changed from prior to being pregnant to during your pregnancy and now postpartum?
Sure. And I think like a good place to start with the nutrition piece is before pregnancy. Right now, my count has really transitioned into being very, I think, pregnant mom focused, because I talk a lot about that. And the thing that I really try to stress to people is that you have to focus on nutrition before you even get pregnant, because, you know, trying to not gain weight during pregnancy is not only dangerous, it's just not the time to really think about being in your optimal kind of health place. So, I mean, I think even a year before pursuing, you know, having a baby, making sure that you're getting all of, you know, the core important nutrients in, start taking a prenatal supplement as soon as you know that you're going to start family planning. I think those are areas that really, really need to be focused on. And then you can ensure that when you're pregnant, I read somewhere that there's very little you can do to negatively affect like a good pregnancy, if your baby's healthy, growing inside. And to some extent, that's true. Sometimes we overstress about things that are out of our control. But to the extent that we can control, you know, things, I think that is the area that moms should focus on. So making sure that you're getting, you know, EPA and DHA are things that you should think about even before pregnancy. So moms start taking omega-3s when they're pregnant. Do it before and keep doing it after. It's an area that a lot of people are deficient in, unless you're eating a lot of eggs and, you know, fatty fish like the salmon. And, you know, there's a lot of fear about mercury in fish. And I'll talk more about that when we get into kind of like what not to eat and what to be careful of. But yeah, like focusing on those really essential nutrients. Those are the things that we can't get from, that our body can't make. And that includes things like, you know, the omega-3 fatty acids and, you know, certain amino acids that our body can't make. So yeah, protein, fat. And then while you're pregnant, you know, making sure that you're getting folate and DHA and the nutrients that are essential for building a healthy brain and, you know, growth for your growing baby. And then what else you said before, during, and after.
Yeah. So how has, like, your nutrition changed from what you were eating during your pregnancy to what are you focusing now on postpartum, now that the baby really isn't, I guess, taking all your nutrients unless you're breastfeeding?
Not breastfeeding. And that's – I stopped breastfeeding when Sophie, like, officially stopped when she was about 5 months.
That's a long time.
Yeah, well, what no one tells you is that, like, everyone's milk supply is different, and sometimes it takes a bit longer for it to go away. And so I found myself at various times, like, having to feed her, even if I hadn't had a milk supply in a few days. Like, suddenly I would be full. So it was a really weird experience, like, the whole weaning process. But yeah, now I would say my diet is much, much closer to what it was before baby, which is, you know, focusing on hunger and fullness cues. And I kind of base it around what my activity level is, my but really hunger. I think that's the greatest indicator of when I need to eat first and foremost and how much. So I've gotten a lot more into the intuitive. I'm not like 100% intuitive eating supporter, but really kind of getting back to, you know, I'm hungry, so I need to eat. Just that instinct that we seem to sometimes lose connection with. So, I mean, when I was pregnant, I ate a lot more. I ate a lot more carbs and more like processed carbs. I kind of was just looser in general with my diet because my needs were different. And because I had issues with eating a large quantity, I had to get creative. So I think that can be a challenge sometimes when a mom is pregnant of figuring out, okay, like, how do I get all these nutrients in if I don't have a lot of room or I have heartburn or any other, you know, kind of annoying sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
It's off on my phone. It was working for a second, so I apologize for that.
No worries.
But yeah, dealing with like, nausea in the first trimester, I stressed a lot because I was constantly getting sick or feeling sick. And so some days I was living on, you know, to be honest, Burger King, biscuits. Like, I would just go through the drive-thru and order biscuits. Like, it's not ideal, but if it's what I could do, it's what I could do. And, you know, my daughter came out totally healthy. So a lot of my fears were kind of, you know, just based on some too much information at times of like what I should be doing. But yeah, like, pregnancy diet's going to look very different than normal diet a lot of times because of these limiting factors.
Now, what about your diet when you were breastfeeding? So I'm super curious where that kind of comes in. Was your pregnancy diet and your breastfeeding diet, and I use the word diet loosely, I really just mean like your meal, like, were they similar because essentially Sophie was still, you know, getting all her nutrients from you, or did you eat differently?
I ate a little differently because I wanted to make sure that, like, I generally, in my normal diet, I am gluten sensitive. So I have a lot of digestive discomfort when I eat gluten, and I did an elimination diet to determine that. So I usually am gluten-free, like, 90% of the time. When I was breastfeeding, though, I did eat gluten, and I ate more dairy and things that I just felt would ensure I was getting nutrients from, you know, areas that are easy to be deficient in when you're breastfeeding, like vitamin D, because a lot of those things are fortified. So I did really ensure that I was getting a lot of, like, B vitamins and vitamin D and calcium and, again, the fish oil, like, getting the omega-3s in. So I think, you know, we can focus a lot on what not to eat, but I think an easier way to kind of foolproof sanity check it all is to focus on what you are eating, and that's focusing on adding more nutrients. So I think, you know, a lot of moms are really stressed about postpartum body and wanting to get their body back, but it's, you know, it's not the time to really stress about dieting, and your body will go back to normal. It takes time. You know, I do this for a living, and it took me months, and it's, you know, between hormones and everything else going on, we have to be kind and gentle and So if we remove the focus from that and think more about what our baby needs and what our body needs to produce, you know, really nutritious milk for them. So yeah, I would focus on that, the vitamins and the nutrients.
I totally agree. I definitely think we need to focus on what you can have as opposed to what you can't have or what you shouldn't have. But yes. Are there any foods that aren't safe for pregnancy or breastfeeding?
I think that it's just like with pregnancy, you know, being careful with fish that are high in mercury. But I think that's just something you should do anyway. So a lot of the advice for pregnant and breastfeeding moms, I think, are things that we should just be aware of. Because a lot of times, you know, you can be an extreme sushi eater, and that's not healthy. So it's applying moderation and balance. So, you know, being careful with that. Definitely with pregnancy, raw meat. I think, you know, trying to avoid any food contamination, that's just more to ensure that you're not getting sick. I think that's where a lot of that comes from. But, I mean, there's just a lot of conflicting information out there. And I don't want to tell someone, like, don't eat Brussels sprouts. Like, I mean, when Sophie had gas when I was breastfeeding, like, you know, I would get advice to try to not eat cruciferous veggies. And so I would do these things, and I realized, like, it wasn't affecting her at all. By the time the milk gets to her, it's like, you know, it's all kind of mixed up. So there isn't a ton that we are impacting through diet. Obviously, limiting alcohol, I think toxins. You talk a lot about this, and I love that you focus so much on, you know, the products that we're using on our bodies. And I think that is probably one of the biggest areas that we can impact and focus on. Just, you know, don't drink a lot of alcohol. Like, one glass of wine is fine, but,
right,
you know, a happy hour with your girlfriends when you have to breastfeed in 2 hours, maybe not the best idea. So,
I totally agree.
Yeah. So I think it's more, more focusing on the balance and avoiding things that could potentially make you sick, because that could make, you know, your baby sick.
100%. It's just so crazy, because I actually had the same experience now that I'm breastfeeding with Lizzie, that, you know, she's so super gassy. And you get all this advice, like, don't have Brussels sprouts, don't have chocolate, don't have coffee, don't have this, don't have that. I'm like, okay, what can I have? What is safe? What, like, I'm eating fruits and vegetables and, you know, all good things, and you're telling me I can't have these things. So I totally agree with you. Everything in moderation, and just, like, the basics, like, you know, don't have too much fish and things like that are things that we really just have to apply, you know, common sense.
Yeah, 100%. And I will say, the last nutrition class I took in the fall, my professor, she was a dietitian, but also a lactation consultant and specialist. So she really put my mind at ease about a lot of things that I was stressed about, because, you know, I consume a lot of information as well. And, you know, the more you read, the more you can stress about stuff. And she basically said, like, so much of the things people worry about are just not necessary. You read that one horrible experience that someone had, and that's one in, like, a million, you know? And
right.
If you live each day being so fearful of, you know, whether or not you're – it's hard, because we're moms, and this is our first kid. We want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to make sure they're healthy. But yeah, she basically, you know, she said that a lot of it is just, it just comes down to thinking about what's good for us. And if it's good for us, it's probably good for them too.
Absolutely. I think another real fear is, you know, you don't want your baby to be allergic to anything that you're eating. I know Lizzie was getting rashes on her stomach for a while. And I was like, okay, let's try and do the elimination diet. I just was just worried that maybe she would be allergic to dairy or gluten or, you know, I think it's a really tough balance between eating whatever you want and just kind of being mindful that their bodies are still little and everything is new to them. And yes. You were kind of talking a little bit about this off air about allergy testing for babies. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I've partnered with a company, and I'll reveal this. I'm going to actually, I'll send you information after I talk to you, because it's this company, Ready Set Food, and they have these powders that introduce the main allergens to babies starting as young as 3 months, and even allergies that the parents might have, because for a long time, you know, exactly what you're saying. For a long time, we've been told, you know, if you're allergic to something, don't give it to your kid. But studies actually show that early introduction actually can reduce the risk of developing those allergies, even if the parents have them. So, of course, every baby is different, and it's kind of the goal really should be to introduce on a regular basis. And I think one of the issues with allergy introduction is that it's not usually consistent. Like maybe one day you'll get eggs, but then the next day you're doing something else. So through this process, it's repeat exposure so that their systems can build up a tolerance immunity to it. And that's kind of the trick, more or less, to avoiding developing the allergies. That repeat exposure over time leads to immunity. So definitely researching it more, and I'll have more and more information the more I learn about it, but that's kind of the 10,000-foot view, if you will, of where my knowledge is. But it's such a cool area, and I'm really into it. So I'm sure I'll have more information in the future to send your way, and you can share with your followers as well, and it might be very helpful to moms who don't know how to navigate that space.
Absolutely. I think that's definitely a very real fear, because you see all these kids who now have, like, these peanut allergies and things like that, and, you know, even if your kid is allergic to it, I think you would want to find out early on while you're, you know, controlling their intake of it and figuring it out, as opposed to, you know, being at a birthday party or something where you're not aware and, you know, testing it out.
Completely. And that's what a lot of the research really is looking at. And what they found is that, first of all, introducing it in a way that's very structured and controlled, because, you know, you don't want to introduce a lot of things at once, then you really don't know what's causing the issue. And I think sometimes parents, especially, you know, we're new parents, we don't know, like, how much to give or, like, how many times should we give it. And so by following this kind of protocol of, like, every 4 or 5 days, you don't introduce something new until, 4 or 5 days. So that you can really identify if there's an issue or if they're okay. So so I think that piece is really important, is sticking to kind of what these clinical trials have identified as being, you know, the right amount of time and all of that. So to keep it safe.
Definitely. So kind of just tying off on that before I go back to asking you a little bit about your own nutrition, you... Correct me if I'm wrong, but you did the baby-fed weaning with Sophie, correct?
Yes.
Can you just explain to everybody a little bit more about that? I feel like I'm talking to more and more moms, and they just aren't aware that that is also an option. And I just find it so fascinating, especially because you're a nutritionist and a dietitian student, and that's the process that you chose to introduce foods to your daughter. And that's the one I am hoping to choose next month when we start.
Yeah, so with baby led, I guess I took an approach. I kind of made it my own. I with everything I do with Sophie, I try to not be so like textbook about it, because then I don't feel like I'm really giving her a chance to, you know, explore and use her own creativity and where she is developmentally, because every baby's different. And so my approach to baby-led was first letting her show me cues that she was ready. I didn't base my food introduction plan on a certain age. I think she was about 5.5 months when I, no, before that, 4.5 months. Yeah, it was around then. Every day. I mean, you know, every day kind of wants to say, I'm like, how old is she now? Yeah, she's about 4.5 months. And it's because she started reaching for food and was trying to mimic what I was doing and was very curious. And so I went with that. And I started just with like textures, letting her play with, you know, a blueberry to see what that feels like. You know, giving her a piece of avocado, what does that feel like? Because so much of their first introduction to food is exploratory. They've never tasted these things before. They've never felt them. So it isn't really about the nutrients so much as getting them comfortable with food and learning how to do it. The motor skill piece, I think, is so important. Making sure that your baby is physically able to eat the food. So it needs to be, you know, they need to be able to sit up. They need to be able to lean their body forward. And so that was one big thing I did initially, was make sure that I didn't spoon feed her. She like reached for the spoon. So she was getting it as opposed to me forcing it. So that's very different than what our parents did. I am pretty sure my my mom and grandparents were just like, here's a piece of chicken. It's and I'm still alive somehow. So, you know, they did something right, I guess. But I think we're just learning more and more, like our generation especially, on, you know, other ways of doing it that are a little bit more, you know, based on where the baby is developmentally. So
100%. Actually, Lizzie's been doing that. If I have her on my lap and I'm eating, she'll like move her mouth towards whatever food I'm putting in my mouth. And I'm like, you are totally ready to start exploring with the food. And I'm excited for it. It looks so fun.
It is really fun. It's also scary because especially once they start getting teeth, they get a little bit more ambitious sometimes. So, so yeah, like the other day I was in this mommy and me yoga class and Sophie's just on the move. She is not attached to me at all. And it's funny, the instructor is this, like child psychology, you know, she's a therapist and also a yoga teacher. And she was telling me that Sophie's very, you know, she has secure attachment. And I'm like, cool, I guess I'm doing something right then. Aww. Because she's like going up to every kid and stealing their snacks. Because the moms bring in, she's like in the toddler class now. So the kids are all eating their snacks. So she was eating goldfish and these like veggie chip things, very like solid food you have to chew. And I was so nervous, but she ate it. She like figured it out. But then the next day I gave her a piece of, I think it was like a tomato, and she started choking on it. I'm like, this is soft. The thing you had before was hard. And so it does get a little nerve-wracking when, so yeah, every parent should get CPR certification and training, because, you know, those things do happen. They're going to choke. You just have to know when they start eating, they're going to. And just being prepared and, you know, not freaking out, just responding appropriately. Because, there have been some times I'm home alone and I'm like, what do I do? Okay, I guess I'm just going to do what they, going to do the back pat thing and then do the mouth sweep. And anyway.
Oh my gosh, how nerve-wracking. That's funny because actually one of the first nights when we came home from the hospital, I was like in total new mom mode and, you know, you hear your baby making noises while they're sleeping, and I'm like, oh my God, is she okay? And I was literally looking up, like, CPR videos just in case. I'm like, I need to have this knowledge just in case. You never know. But, of course, she was totally fine, and I was just being paranoid. But
those sounds are really scary.
They're petrifying.
Co-sleeping because of them. Like, I would just lay there all night just, like, anxious. I mean, for other reasons we'll talk about, but also because the sounds just, I always had to check her and make sure she was breathing and.
Oh my gosh. Totally. Like 1,000 times a night, I like get up and I'm looking at her and I'm like, okay, she's breathing. She's okay.
Yeah.
So I
didn't ever.
So I want to talk a little bit more about your journey postpartum. You shared a little bit, I know, on a Sweat Life about your thyroiditis and your hormones after pregnancy. So would you like to share that story with us a little bit?
Sure, as paraphrased as I can, which is never possible for me. But yeah, so I kind of came out. First of all, I had a really traumatic labor, like no stretch of the imagination, like I'm not exaggerating. It was a 56-hour labor because
I was induced. God.
Little backstory on that. My daughter, when she was about 32 weeks, I went in for just a regular checkup, and my doctor didn't like my measurement. At that point, I wasn't doing ultrasounds anymore, but he didn't like the growth. And so then I had an ultrasound, and her abdomen appeared to be growing smaller than the rest of her body. So they usually call that small for gestational age, or SGA. And when that happens, you have to get hooked up to the Doppler machine twice a week to make sure that their heart is beating and everything. So my like foray, or, you know, the months leading up to having my daughter, were really nerve-wracking. And I definitely developed a form of anxiety, depression leading up. I became just very withdrawn and scared, and you know, understandably. But getting hooked up twice a week and waiting to see if my daughter's heart is beating, it's not great. So as I approached the due date, my doctor was confident that she was growing properly and everything was okay, and whatever the issue was had resolved itself. But of course, at that point, I was like, nope, when my due date comes, she's coming out. Like, mother intuition, I can't. So when my due date hit and she didn't come, we scheduled an induction, and it took 3 days for her to enter the world. And I went through all of the stages of like labor, even though I was put on Pitocin at a certain point. Like, my water broke on its own, like everything you want to happen. I dilated, you know, all of that stuff, but it just, like, she wasn't coming. So I came really close to having a C-section, like, last minute. She decided, like, okay, it's game time, like, procrastinated. So, like, long story short, it was just, I was on a lot of fluids, and so, and with the Pitocin and fluids, by the time I left the hospital, like, my body really went into kind of, like, overdrive shock, and my immune system attacked my thyroid. I didn't know this at the time. I thought I was just experiencing, like, the effects of your hormones kind of getting back to normal, and maybe some postpartum thyroiditis, postpartum anxiety, which is what I was initially diagnosed with. So I was put on medicine and went to therapy and all of this stuff, which honestly I think is not necessarily the medicine part, but I think every mom, you know, a little therapy can be helpful, because this is a big life transition. And just having that, like, outside perspective and that person to listen to you. And so that piece actually was really, really helpful. But it wasn't until I was about 4 months postpartum that I just knew something was off. Like, my weight was fluctuating like crazy. And I'm not someone who's regularly weighing myself. Like, my clothes are a pretty good indicator of, like, where I am. And I'm always, like, within the same range. But I was like, 1 week my pants wouldn't fit, and then the next week they're like too fit. Like, I didn't understand what was happening, and I told my doctor, like, something is wrong. Like, I shouldn't be gaining, losing 10 pounds in a week. But on top of that, like, I was still having insomnia, and I've never been an insomniac. And basically, I was just kind of told that, oh, it's probably, you know, just with breastfeeding, it makes you hungrier. So I was kind of more or less diet shamed. Not intentionally, but that's how it came across to me. Like, oh, you just don't know what you're eating. And I'm like, dude, I'm in school for clinical nutrition. Like, I know what I'm eating.
Right.
And there's no water weight does not make you fluctuate like that. But the insomnia and my hair was like falling out more than my mom friends who were going through postpartum thyroiditis. So I went around my doctor and I ended up going to a functional medical clinic. And right when I went in, I said, okay, this is what I've researched. I know it's my thyroid. I just want to confirm that. And then I can take steps to resolve it. But I don't think they were prepared for someone walking in and saying, test for this, this, and this. They're like, oh, okay. So you're going to tell us what to do. So they tested my A1C, which actually came back that I was pre-diabetic, which is insane because, I mean, you know me, I don't eat sugar.
Right.
I like rarely eat anything besides like fruit sugar. So I was like, that's weird to be pre-diabetic. My thyroid was basically my, so my thyroid was off the charts. The TS3 and 4 were like crazy. So I was majorly hyperthyroid. But because of that, it was throwing off everything else. So my cortisol was extremely high. All of these things. Like, basically, my body was, like, freaking out. And so I did, like, send those results to my doctor. And I was like, look, all you have to do is test somebody. When someone comes to you and says there's a problem, just test them. Like, I could have gotten very, very sick. So I did more research. I found a great endocrinologist. And when I went into his office, he was like, you found me on your own and you did this and this and this. He was like, he was pretty impressed. And I was actually like happy with myself.
Yeah.
For doing what I did. And like the moral of the story isn't to fear medicine or doctors, because I mean, I'm more or less going down that route. And that's a huge, I think, influence for me in my work, is to ensure I'm doing everything I can through my work to improve the areas that there are problems in healthcare. So I think, you know, people get worried that doctors don't care and they don't listen. They're, first of all, they just have too many patients. They can't always, you know, diagnose. If people can see functional medicine doctors, I mean, that's a whole other conversation. I think you should, if you can. It's not a reality for everyone. And that's why it's important to be your own advocate. If something feels wrong, you know your body better than anyone else. You can't put all of your trust in one doctor or one system to do all of that for you. So by being your own advocate, by knowing when you need to get things tested, you're just taking those extra steps that people who don't know what you're feeling and what your normal is like, they can't do that for you. So I am now 9 months postpartum, and my thyroid, by, you know, following every step that the endocrinologist, and this doctor, by the way, is not a pill pusher. He's very much a fan of trying to do everything you can through supplement intake and diet changes. So I was just very on top of eating in a way that supported hormone health. Taking the supplements that were recommended and taking them on time and religiously every day. And within 3 months, my hormones were back in the normal range. So you can't, there's a lot that we can do if we just, you know, don't let ourselves off the hook. And we see health as not, you know, this constant place that you're just going to stay within. Sometimes you have to make changes and like make modifications to what is your normal in order to be normal. If that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I love that you were truly your own advocate and you just didn't rely on what your doctor initially told you as your diagnosis. Because if you would have just relied on that, like you said, you could have gotten really sick. But because you were your own advocate and you did your own research and you went and saw another doctor, you were able to resolve it, you know, in a pretty timely manner.
Yeah. And it's possible to do that, I think, but it takes a commitment. And granted, this is what I do and this is my life. So it's a little easier for me to sit here and say, okay, just do this and this and this, because it's what I breathe and what I, you know, it's my existence. But I think every person can do that for themselves. It's just a matter of prioritizing it and making sure that you never let your health, you know, fall behind or become a lower priority on your list. Like kids, they need their parents to be healthy. So I'm not an effective mom if I'm not taking care of myself to the best of my ability.
Absolutely. And I feel like it's really hard for new moms postpartum to kind of figure out if there's something wrong with their bodies or if they're still just like in that transition period where their hormones are out of touch, you know, because they did just have a baby. What are some of the better hormone testing options out there?
Yeah, so I just had a simple blood test, and that was all I needed. And I actually think that's a good place to start. There are three kind of, well, the main testing options. There are three of them. One is blood, and it's a little limited because it can just give you numbers based on what is in your blood at that time. It can't really give you that more historical view. And it doesn't give you a deeper dive into, you know, where your cortisol is at different times of the day. I mean, you really would need to get a more comprehensive test. Saliva is another test option. That's a little bit more of, that's a deeper dive. It's just a little bit more precise. And then the one that is really like kind of I wouldn't say standard because it's not really available for everyone and insurance doesn't always cover it. So it's a little pricey, but the Dutch test, which is the dried urine test for comprehensive hormones, it's really the gold standard is what I meant to say. But I would only advise getting that once a blood test has revealed that there are imbalances. And if you want to see on a deeper level what that looks like, it gives you a deeper dive into like cortisol, which it seems like a lot of people are having cortisol issues now. And I don't know how much of that is environmental impact, you know, these toxins that are around, how much of that is just daily stressors. It's probably a culmination of all of that. But cortisol seems to be a really big issue in I think it's something that moms especially should be aware of because it can throw so many other things off.
Now, in your opinion, how long do you think moms should wait and give their body time to heal before they go for hormone testing?
I don't think it's ever necessarily too early. It's important to know that certain hormones can be off. But there's a range of normal within the abnormal, if that makes sense. So, you know, if abnormal is normal, like, what is extreme within that? And I think if a mom is worried that she might have postpartum anxiety or depression or some other issue, you know, let yourself kind of get through that, like, first few months because sleep, you know, your hormones are going to be impacted by lack of sleep. That's just a given. And I think coming to terms with that and accepting that it's not going to be forever. So the first few months of sleep deprivation, you know, to the best of your ability, like making sure you have a strong support system, do things outside of the testing first. You know, go to therapy if you need it. Go to mommy and me classes. Those really saved me. Like sometimes I just needed to sit in a circle with people and just cry and we all just kind of cry together. It's really like cathartic and helpful. And then, you know, I went at about 4 months. I think that's pretty reasonable. You know, by that point, my daughter had been sleeping through the night. So it wasn't sleep deprivation, even though I was still having insomnia. Yeah, I think that's probably the best approach is kind of, you know, give it a little bit of time, but not too much. Don't let it go like a year. And also, I've heard that from some moms when I was looking for feedback that like it can take a year for things to show up. So postpartum depression and anxiety especially, those don't necessarily hit you right out of the gate. Sometimes, you know, your kid can turn a year old and suddenly you're like, I feel very weird. So there isn't necessarily like a, you know, at 4 months you should do this. If your kid's a year old and you start feeling strange, go in. I mean, really at any point in your life, but when it comes to, you know, the postpartum period, just being aware constantly of how you're feeling, checking in with yourself, and getting help when you need it.
That was absolutely the most perfect response. And especially, you know, the first part where you were saying that it really isn't ever too early after, you know, you take those initial first few months, because there are normal and then there are, you know, extreme ranges with your hormones. So I really appreciated that you touched on that. Thank you. So yeah, I just feel like you have been really on the go lately between your classes, and you're always taking Sophie to Mommy and Me, and you recently launched your podcast. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what inspired you to start your own podcast?
Yeah, I have a lot to say, if you can't tell. So,
but good information that you're sharing.
I'm sorry?
But you're sharing great information.
Oh, I appreciate that. I'm glad that it's helpful, and that's the point of it. And that was really the reason that I created the podcast, was saw this, and I really saw it in stories. As you know, with it, we're always up against the challenge of, algorithms on Instagram, and I was seeing this decline on the post side of impressions and likes and comments, and I realized that because of the way the algorithms are, it's kind of to the advantage of people who are getting like the thousands of likes. And so I started doing more of the stories, and the feedback I was getting from the stories was like, I wish you had more information. I wish that, you know, I wasn't just reading this stuff, because it is, there's limited space. And if you write too much, the characters, I get complaints all the time about, like, can you make the font bigger? I can't read. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Like,
what?
I can't make. And so the podcast just gives me a longer format to be able to say more, and to give like the information I can't fit, especially on posts, because sometimes it's like an epic novel length and I'm like, oh my God, no one's going to read this anyway. But you know what? I don't really care at the end of the day, because I think that what I'm sharing is valuable, and I do think it helps people. And as long as it is, I'm just going to keep on every single format that I can, spreading the message of, you know, living a balanced and healthy life. So.
And what are some of the topics that you have discussed so far, and what is kind of the goal for your podcast?
I think I talk a lot about the balance, so dispelling diet myths and using more of an intuitive eating approach to things like healthy snacking habits and how to approach holidays. And I developed a method, which I've called the Kenner method, which is really kind of built around this approach to living a healthy lifestyle without becoming obsessive or restrictive or overthinking it. So now, and that's kind of the direction that I plan to go, is to focus on topics related to nutrition, health, wellness, but from this very centered place of, you know, keeping it simple, eating the appropriate amount of food for each person. And that's a big thing. And the more that I learn in school, the more I realize, how much individuality is, influences like our experience. And so, you know, I can't give one example of like a diet that works for everyone, because that's just not the case. And so being able to use a very broad approach to what a healthy lifestyle looks for most, and within that there's a lot of variance. So yeah, that's kind of my focus and my direction.
And where can everybody find your podcast?
Um, So the podcast is Learned, Heard, and Stirred, and that it's on iTunes. It's on most podcast platforms, and yeah.
So exciting. And pimp yourself out. Tell everybody where they can find you on Instagram, your website, and the like.
Sure. Fit Fab Well by Chanel. And that's everything. I don't do a lot of Facebook anymore. It's just I kind of have things feed from Instagram. Instagram is really where you're going to see the most. I'm kind of sporadic with everything else.
And I have one more question for you. What is your favorite flavor of kombucha?
Oh, gosh. It varies, but I really like, I've been obsessed with the, why am I blanking on the name? It's the blood orange ginger.
Oh, by Healthy.
So what's that?
It's by Healthy.
Yes, the Health Aid one. I was like, I know this name is simple. That one I am so... my big thing with sugar, and sometimes they just get too much sugar. If it's like 14 grams of sugar in the total thing, I just don't want it. So that's the one that is good, but I think it has 10, which is like as max as I'll go.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I totally appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.